You are now listening to the Geeky Natural Mom podcast, a podcast of encouragement, awareness, and motivation, and where positivity is the best policy, with your host, Yasmeen Nicole. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I hope you guys are safe and well. You already know I got to start the show off with gratitude. So thank you so much for your love and support. It's been amazing. I'm so happy about this episode and the conversation that I had. This is my first guest on the pod, so I'm like super stoked. And the conversation was amazing. I'm just in awe of what's happening right now. And also, you know, with the times and, you know, things are changing and we got to keep continuing to do the work. Like, it doesn't stop. Like, we have to do the work, but also make sure we take breaks when we do the work so we're not suffering from burnout, so we're not overwhelmed. So make sure you take breaks fighting in a resistance. I'm so happy that Leah was able to come on and talk about everything. We talked about allyship. We talked about what's going on in the healthcare community, well, in the healthcare system. And she works at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia with infectious diseases. So we talk a little bit about what's going on with COVID and stuff like that. So, as I said, very, very, very amazing. I'm just happy. Like, I'm smiling from ear to ear because, like, conversation is so key, and we learn from each other when we converse. So I felt like I learned a lot from her, and she probably learned a lot from me. And it's just amazing how energy and communication goes a long way. And if we continue that, we can make a lot of changes, and we can speak up and, you know, as I said, fight for the resistance. So without further ado, here's the episode of this episode of my conversation with Leah Foster. And I also want to put a disclaimer out there. You might hear little children in the background because, again, I am a mother. And yeah. But again, without further ado, here's the conversation with Leah Foster. So, hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I hope you guys are doing well. So, I have a special guest on with us today. Oh, I'm here with Leah. And we were doing some conversation before I started recording. So, and I felt like, you know, us conversing, I feel like some things can, you know, can be implemented. And with the times that we're having right now, and also, you know, with trying to be good allies and, you know, trying to build relationships and all the things. Like, people need to know what's happening. So I'm so happy that she's on. And Leah, whenever you're ready, you can start. Thank you for joining me once again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really, really glad to be here. So we were just talking about some disparities and talking about the idea of allyship and what that means. And as somebody who is, you know, on my journey of allyship, if you will, you know, not going after perfection and just really trying to do the best that I can do every day, I've been doing a lot of listening, a lot of reading. I'm really glad you're having me on today because the conversation we had before this was really cool. But we started talking about health disparities and, you know, being a Black mother of a son with autism. We were discussing what it's like in the healthcare system for Black families and how difficult that can be, especially in mental health care.
Right.
So, you know, I had some depression issues in high school. My mom went through crazy hoops with insurance companies. She didn't have the same barriers that you have just simply because of a color of your skin. There are well-documented disparities in the way that doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers treat Black people in a hospital setting, not believing symptoms, you know, downplaying pain that's reported. The prescribing rate for pain medication is so much lower for African Americans because simply doctors don't believe it. Mortality rate of Black mothers is significantly higher than those of white women. It's absolutely unacceptable. And the sort of like barriers that you have to jump through just to be heard, just to be believed, is something that isn't really discussed as much as it should be, as a lot of things aren't. But I really have been grateful to be able to listen to some of the stuff that you've been talking about being the mother of somebody who's neurotypical and dealing with your child, because, you know, you can scream as loud as you want to and still you're not going to be heard as much as you would if your skin color was different.
Right. I had a question about like insurance companies, because I read somewhere that since the protests are happening and then we have like all, you know, this violence and stuff like that, is it true that with insurance companies they won't accept your claim if you were in like a protest and you got hurt or something like that? I just want validation on that, because I've seen that like floating around on social media. So like I wanted to get your expertise and also your like your thoughts on that.
I don't know specifically about that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I'd love to do some more research to see whether that's a fact or not. I do know that just claims in general tend to be harder to get filled for people of color as opposed to white people, just because the whole system is designed to work against you in the first place.
Right.
So there's more back work that needs to be done to even get to a point where your claim can be reviewed. There's often barriers with access because of, you know, like internet, faxing, whatever. So there's just structural barriers there that make those things more difficult, that affect, you know, predominantly people in poverty as well as people in urban areas. But I'm not sure about the process. That's a very good question. I know that there has been a push to, like, we're raising all this money for bail funds and for, you know, to cover co-pays for people who have been injured in protests. We shouldn't have to raise money. That should just be something that our government does.
Right.
Like, insurance companies should cover it. It shouldn't be something where you have to solicit $50 donations from Joe Schmo, who's not getting paid enough in the first place anyway. So,
right. I also wanted to kind of share how like the racial differences with like my mom. When my mom was guys. So when my mom was diagnosed with cancer, she, like, it was very hard for her to get insurance at the time. And mind you, we did all the paperwork. We did, like, everything that we were supposed to do, but they kept denying her insurance. So, like, we literally, like, had to jump hoops through hoops, so she finally can, like, pay for her chemo and stuff like that. Because at this time, like, her job was still kind of paying her, but like she was literally she was not able to work. So that's why we were working on getting insurance, so we were able to, you know, she was able to get the treatment she was supposed to. So long story short, she finally got the insurance after, you know, going through all these hoops. And I feel like even like for myself now, with like different providers, we got to go through all these hoops where, you know, we have to get all the stuff that most likely we probably don't even need, but it's a difference, you know, when you're a Black mother that you have to have all this stuff and probably still get denied anyway. So I also wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Matches up, it aligns with, you know, all of the other injustices that are, you know, currently in place against Black people. You know, it's making everything harder to just do the basic things that, you know, we as, quote, like Americans are able to do. The idea of like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, just get a job, that kind of thing. There's a lot of really negative rhetoric surrounding that. And I mean, the same thing applies to healthcare and to getting the kind of treatments that people need. The time that it took you to resubmit those forms, like your mother could have been receiving treatment earlier. You know, there's no reason why we should have to wait longer for people of color to receive medical treatment just because either insurance companies or healthcare providers have implicit biases based on skin color. It's absolutely unacceptable. And also, it's also just, you know, a white supremacist system working. You know, there's white supremacy in, you know, all of our institutional systems, and what can we do to, you know, identify those and bring light to them, and then really push for policy change. And it's not as simple as just voting. It's not as simple as just going out and protesting. It's like, what direct action can we take to hold these companies and these legislators accountable for making actual change, you know? But I think part of it is sharing those stories. And I think so much of that has been Black women especially, you know, screaming like, please listen to me. And we haven't been. And that's on, you know, me as a white person, as somebody who, you know, could have listened more and I didn't. And, you know, I take that responsibility and I promise to be better. But, you know, it's talking about like, how do we do something now? It's like, the floor is open, we're amplifying Black voices. But the medical community specifically, because it is health, it is, you know, like mortality rates. It is like, how do we keep people alive? Police brutality is part of it, but also the disparities within the health community is a huge part.
Okay, I just wanted to also ask about, like, you know, like as far as childbirth, it's also, there's like some kind of like racial tensions there with treatment of Black expectant mothers and postpartum. And I know you see children where you work. So I wanted to know, like what was the, like what was your experience, you know, with the children and also like postpartum with Black mothers?
So I work at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I actually work in the Research Institute. So I work with infectious disease doctors. So it's been a very busy couple of months where I'm working anyway.
Oh, wow.
So we've been focusing on COVID. So it's been very busy.
Yeah.
So I don't have as much knowledge about the neonatal stuff. However, from the like medical sociology that I do know about, my mother's a medical sociologist, and I've done like some reading on this because it's just interesting to me. You know, the general idea is that, you know, complications during birth are not taken as seriously. The pain levels that are being reported, they like, medical providers expect Black women to tolerate more pain than white women or white men. So they're less likely to believe when a white woman or a Black woman says that she's in pain. And it's about like not noticing things that they might notice in a white mother in terms of complications. So we do see a much higher mortality rate for Black mothers during childbirth than we do, like dramatically higher. I don't have the number, but it's like, it's absolutely insane. And totally for how much higher it is. There's no reason. And like the only thing that they notice in the difference is race. That is the factor of why it's so much higher. I think they force everything out. I don't have kids, so it's been really interesting to hear you talking about your experiences with children. Like, I don't have kids. I want one someday, but I don't have any.
Yeah.
So what was it like? What were your experiences like during, you know, the birth of your children and aftercare and prenatal care? And how did you notice some of those systems working in a way that was negative?
I can probably speak from probably with my younger son. I was very high risk, and like I would complain about like certain things to the doctor, and it's like, oh no, you know, you'll get past it. But like, through my whole pregnancy, like I was in pain. And then they don't offer, like, I felt like they didn't offer like postpartum like resources, like for mental health and stuff like that. I think towards the end, like she started like asking like, oh, do you need like to see a therapist or blah, 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 blah. But I felt like I didn't have that support really when I was pregnant. And like the aftercare was kind of hard because like, you know, I was losing a lot of blood and it was very hard. And like, they didn't really tell me what was going on and what was happening. Like I felt like I was, like the pain was unbearable. I felt like I had preeclampsia too. So it was just like so difficult. Like I felt like it was going to be the end because like I was in so much pain, and like they didn't really explain or didn't say like what was the problem or like how, you know, how did they treat it or whatever like that. And then I felt kind of isolated and scared to ask because like I felt like I was being scolded. So it was very hard. It was very, very hard.
It's completely unacceptable. And like, the thing is, it's like none of this is new. You know, like your experience echoes tons of other experiences of women who are not believed or are not cared for. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And one thing that I'm hoping to get involved in pushing for is trauma-informed care. Because generational trauma is real, and healthcare providers aren't necessarily trained in how to provide trauma-informed care.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, being a doctor is a job, and there's a lot of very bad doctors and a lot of doctors who do not care.
That's so awful. And
just like we expect our cops to do better, we should also expect our doctors to do better. And part of doing better is implicit bias training, as well as, you know, getting information about trauma-informed care to better, you know, help with the mental health, keeping up mental health of women of color during times where they are especially vulnerable.
And that's a very great point. And I feel like it ties into so much of the postpartum and how we raise our children, because when we deal with those things, it's so traumatic. We don't know how to cope or deal, you know, with that. And, you know, we're taking it out on the children and we're getting frustrated, and it shouldn't be like that. And sometimes like, it'd be a situation where it's fatal because we don't, you know, there's no support there. And it's hard to really, man, I just, that's a fear of for myself, that I don't want to be in a place where I'm like at a low place, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's why I choose to, you know, take care of myself mentally, making sure I am healthy and well-rounded so I'm able to raise my children. But everybody doesn't have that same mindset, or might can't even talk about it, or they feel like they, you know, are being judged about it. So it's really like layers to, you know, the parenting aspect of dealing with trauma and raising children.
It's also so much pressure. Like, that's so much to handle.
Yeah.
Every single day.
Exactly. And like myself, like, I don't have family support, and it's just us. And it's probably the same for others. And, you know, we're basically command central. We have to do all the things. Like, we don't get breaks. We don't, you know, we're always tired. We're always overwhelmed. And, like, people always, you know, think a certain way, or it's judgment or shaming. But, like, you don't understand what this mom or this dad or this caregiver is going through. And I have 3 children on a spectrum, so it's a lot that I gotta remember. There's different providers that I have to stay on top of. That's added pressure, and then like the daily struggles. So that's typically it's levels. It's so many levels.
I mean, it's a whole other job, you know? Like, mm-hmm. providing care for 3 children is literally another full-time job, and providing care for children who need health care is another full-time job.
Absolutely.
Dealing with insurance company is a nightmare.
Oh, man. Tell me about, like, how it's been during this time with COVID and everything, with your job, and what's been going on.
With what's been going on with, like, just like COVID in general, or like the
just with COVID in general, and then if you wanted to add on to that.
COVID's been nuts. I work with pediatric infectious disease doctors. I do not have a medical degree. Like, I need to put that out there. I'm like not, you know, like, I have a psych degree. It's not anything like that.
Yeah.
But I do work with the research team. I have done research in the past. I'm doing research support for this team. I'm working with a doctor who is helping with the city of Philadelphia's COVID response.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been wild. It's been really crazy. We first got word of it in late January, and sort of like ramped up. We had a couple weeks heads up compared to, you know, everybody freaking out about it. And, you know, I'm saying this lightly because it's very uncomfortable and it's really like a scary thing. But it's not funny, none of it's funny. We ended up going work from home the second week of March. And continue to do so. I actually am now out in California with my family instead of Philadelphia, because my old apartment was not super conducive to getting a bunch of work done. So I'm here. But we have had, it's been busy. You know, it doesn't affect children in the same way that it affects adults. However, we were preparing for overflow from the University of Pennsylvania Hospital in case that was going to happen. But the response efforts have really been about informing the public, about making sure that people are following masking procedures, and all of that was really fluid, right? At the beginning, we didn't think we had to wear masks, we didn't know that they were effective, you know, we didn't really know. We thought that, like, you know, you have to leave your packages outside for 4 days or else you're going to catch COVID when you bring them inside, you know? It's never changing. situation. So a big part of what my doctors have been doing has been trying to combat misinformation and, you know, the anti-vaxxers and sort of like a lot of people who are, you know, fighting against like the reality on the ground, which is that people are dying. And we do really still have to be concerned, even if it's not killing kids, it's manifesting very differently in children. So children are experiencing this thing called COVID toes. There's like all kinds of, you know, weird respiratory things are happening. There's children who are coming down with cases that look like Kawasaki's disease. It's really wide ranging. This thing is manifesting differently. The rates have gone down a bit. It is summertime. They fully expect there to be a resurgence in the fall. So yeah, prepare yourself. The understanding is that it will come back in the fall. So, you know, there's the debate about the economic benefits of reopening, but we don't know what things are going to look like after the protests. You know, people have been out, not necessarily social distancing. A lot of protesters are wearing masks. Some of them are not. So it's kind of a wait and see. We're not really sure how that's going to affect infection rates and whether there's going to be a bump. But it'll be interesting to see. Currently, we are working on a research study testing antibody levels in Children's Hospital employees. I think something like 5,000 employees are going in and getting blood draws to see who has antibodies and who doesn't, looking at their travel history, that type of thing. It's one of the biggest studies in the country in terms of employees. It's really cool stuff. So that I'll find out if I have antibodies, which is kind of cool. But yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of research that's happening, and you know, the groups that I'm working with are heavily involved. It's really cool having kind of like an insider look. I think it's helping my anxiety because I have somebody to like talk to about it instead of just getting my info from the news. So if there's anything you want to know, let me know and I will ask my doctors.
Cool.
I'm trying to like help calm people down a little bit about it. Not that it's not scary, but it's like, you know, there are people who have information about it, and I know I'm a super anxious person, and if I didn't have like a direct person to ask about it, I'd be freaking out right now. So, you know, masking, washing your hands, social distancing should continue as long as humanly possible until we have a vaccine. Things are gonna start to reopen. And it's really now about risk assessment. So they were talking about protesting, and there's been some chatter online, like all the doctors told us that we had to quarantine. Now they're out, you know, kneeling for Black lives. And the Pediatric Infectious Disease Society put out a really interesting statement saying, racism is a more deadly epidemic than COVID right now. Racism kills more people and has killed more people and is something that we need to deal with right now. Like, I think everybody recognizes that this is a moment, and there's a moment and an opportunity for real change. And it's not that COVID isn't still super dangerous, because it is, but we're doing risk assessment, and we know that letting all of this stuff continue in terms of police brutality and systemic racism is going to have a much larger effect than COVID if we do that. They do suggest that people who are immunocompromised stay home, don't go out if you're over 65, you know, protest at your own risk, be safe when you do it. But if you want to go on protest, just do some risk assessment, think about who you're coming home to.
I think that's great points. The statement that you just spoke about with racism is very powerful. I wanted to ask about your thoughts on how the city handled the pandemic in versus the state, like, what were your thoughts on how it was handled and how, you know, with the guidelines and, you know, with the red and the yellow and the green, like, what were your thoughts on that?
Boy, you got like 3 hours. I mean, there's a, you know, there's, couldn't done better. That's what I'll say. I think there's a lot of things I could have done better. You know, there's, I mean, honestly, I do, like, race has been an issue with COVID the whole time too. So it's actually something that has been like a big discussion in our office about the disparities with COVID and how it's like definitely impacting the African American community more than any other community. Right. And with Philadelphia being a majority minority city, like, we were impacted. However, the sort of like huge boom that they expected it to be like a little New York in terms of like how many people were infected and how many people died, that did not come in the way that we anticipated, and that's because we had a little bit more of a heads up New York did. At the same time, you know, I'm working from home and there's people down the street building condos, and it's you know, the middle of April, and I'm like, why is this happening? So they've been pretty inconsistent about who they like, about enforcement of those rules, which is scary. I think it went on longer than it needed to. You know, the fact that shop doctors were wearing homemade masks and recycling N95 masks because there just weren't enough. That's a nationwide problem, but like, you know, it's hard to see. And at the same time, it could have been a lot worse. So we look at like, you know, Trump's like 2 million deaths, which is like, whatever, you know, like, okay.
Yeah.
All right. The fact is, too many people died. All those people didn't have to die. And we could have done better. And we still did okay, I guess. I don't know. I think it's all messed up. We should have been on lockdown immediately, and we should have like just shut everything down, and we didn't do that.
Yeah.
And proliferated in the community in a way that it didn't need to. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. There was also something I've heard in also kind of goes with the topic of politics. I don't know if you saw the video with Rep. Bryant Sims, and like he kind of just went off on his GOP counterparts about someone testing positive for COVID and not really saying anything and didn't really self-quarantine and put everyone at risk. And I don't know if you heard about that, but I wanted to know like how like the position of power, like you're not you per se, but like where you are, there's a lot of like power in position. Like, do you think that you know, with that situation and also, you know, where you are, precautions could have been better taken care of, or did you think that they didn't care? Like, I just wanted to hear, like, you know, like your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Being close to doctors and people who are in public health, they all took it very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, which is part of the reason why, like, we started work from home pretty early, and we won't be going, like, I won't be going back to the office until, you know, September at the absolute earliest.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why I'm here in California, is because, yeah, I'm not going back anytime soon. So they were serious about it. There was the push to reopen Hanuman. I don't know if you read about that.
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one of my bosses worked on that proposal, which ended up not coming through because the developer is awful and wanted to charge like a bunch of rent for no reason. So yeah, he's this like super rich guy that was like 21st in Locust. And he was like, I'm gonna charge you guys an absorbent amount of rent for you to use this hospital that is like not open, you know, is fully functional, could be ready to go in a second to support people. So instead they had to like build like makeshift tents in the Leo Core Center. It was insane. It's so stupid. So there's like, yeah, so there's power and there's money and there's people looking to profit off of that. So this is somebody who was not in government, but somebody who owned the building. Read an article about this. This is crazy. So like everything was ready to go and this guy was like, yeah, pay me money. Like, you can't use it. They were even like offering to pay him money. He just wanted way too much. So the building sits empty. It's crazy. A lot of people's time is wasted. So there's ways that it could have gone better. I think that there's accountability that needs to happen for our government officials, being like, why did so many people die? Oh, that's the cat. I was wondering who. Come here, buddy. You want to say hi? Okay, never mind. There's accountability that needs to happen for sure. But because I'm working with healthcare workers, their stance is to be overly cautious. And I think the economic stance is let's try to like go, you know, let's try to get back to normal as fast as we can. It's definitely not as bad as some cities. You know, there's places in Texas and the South that open way too early and are seeing really negative effects of that. The Brian Sims video, I didn't see, but I did read about. There is a lot of power concentrated within Philadelphia, and access to that is important. Brian Sims was actually my neighbor at my old
house. What? Are you serious?
Yeah. So yeah, I lived around the corner from him for about a year. And my roommate at the time was friends with his partner. So there was like a connection there. One that I did not use because, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, not thinking about using my platform in a way that's constructive at all. Waving to the guy instead of being like, I can talk to somebody who actually has the power to do something, you know? So I saw what he said. I do think that him calling out people for not reporting that they had COVID was completely reasonable. And I, you know, am frustrated because with the way that our government works, you know, he is one voice. He is not the voice of all. And he can bring light to it, but he alone cannot make change. So, you know, we are unfortunately plagued with a lot of really negative Republican white guys in the Pennsylvania Senate. And we are hoping that, you know, they're not going to make any decisions that will continue to kill Pennsylvanians, you know, and it doesn't look like that's changing anytime soon. So we got to go out and vote, demand policy change. And I'm glad that Brian Sims is, you know, trying to work for that.
That's awesome. I also wanted to know, like, do you think the precautions will be different, you know, once everything kind of gets up and running again? Do you think this, you know, do you think it'll be like be overly cautious or be about the same, or like what do you think will happen like after, once this subsides, if it ever subsides, like will things be different?
Obviously, expert opinion as the I think that there's going to be people who will wear masks for the rest of their lives. I just think it's something that's going to just happen. I think the way that we see in photos of, you know, some countries in Asia, how, you know, some of their society continues to mask when they're sick or something like that, I think we'll see that here. I think that we are currently going through two huge cultural societal shifts that are happening at the same time.
Yeah, sure.
You know, with COVID, things are never gonna be the way that they were before. It's just not gonna happen. Even with a vaccine, things will change in terms of how we work to prevent infections in hospital settings, in terms of backup plans and how we, you know, have resources in storage for an event that may happen like this. Who knows when concert venues are going to be open again? Like, who knows what wrestling's going to look like? If we want to get like serious, like, you know, if I have to watch another like totally silent match just like in the middle of the training arena, like, I'm going to lose my mind.
I miss going to shows so bad.
I know.
Goodness. And I was like all excited for Mania this year, going to Tampa because I've never been to Tampa.
Oh, were you going to Tampa this year?
Yes. And
oh my God.
It was heartbreaking. I think for me, like, I was more sad about missing like all the things that I was doing because like I had some stuff lined up. So like when everything happened, I was kind of like depressed because, like, you know, this is the only time that I had to myself and, you know, my me time. Because, like, doing that stuff, traveling and going to wrestling shows and, like, all that stuff, that was, like, the only time I had to myself. And, like, for all that just to kind of, like, stop it all at once was kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it was like, So, yeah, man, I was so stoked to go to my first Mania, but hopefully, you know, LA is, who knows what happened with LA.
Fingers crossed. I mean, that's the thing is that, like, what we do now really determines what next Mania looks like, right? So,
yeah,
being really careful about washing our hands and practicing social distancing and, you know, masking, super important. If we continue to use those measures and as we transition back into like normal life or like yellow or green or whatever, you know, zone we're in, while still maintaining a lot of those like behaviors, hi. you know, we're more likely to get back to normal soon. I mean, you know, with a vaccine is really gonna be like it's crucial to get to a point where it's like eradicated. Not that we're gonna get there anytime soon, but you know, the idea of getting back to something where we can go to Mania or we can like, you know, my airplane travel here was a nightmare. I was horrified. It was very scary.
Tell me, what was traveling like?
Oh my God, it's terrifying. Oh, like, I wish I had Xanax with me. It was really scary. I flew Southwest. We had a layover in Denver. The Philly airport at 10 o'clock in the morning looked like what it looks like at 5 a.m. when I go, because, like, I don't have a lot of money, so I have to fly for cheap when I fly.
Right.
Flying out here, I usually like get on at like a 5:30 a.m. flight or something crazy, you know.
Right.
I'm there at 10 o'clock. Flight was $100, which is insane.
What?
Across the country for $100. I know. I booked my flight the middle of May, or like the beginning of May, when I found out that we weren't going to be going to the office anytime soon. So I get Southwest. Because there's no cancellation fees, no change fees. So I'm like, if the flight's too busy, get on another flight.
Yeah.
The airport was totally empty. The flight was not. They have been blocking off middle seats but every seat besides the middle seat was full. It was a pretty full plane.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, which was horrifying. I had one N95 mask that we had left over from painting. So it was like one of the big ones. Really hard to breathe with one of those, especially for like a 4-hour flight. Layover in Denver was fine. Nothing was open. Another flight, same thing, totally full. I could not, like, again, besides middle seats did stay open, but that's not 6 feet, you know? What I would say is, if you don't have to fly, don't fly right now.
Yeah, because I was wondering, I'm like, what was flying like, and, like, I think it's gonna change, like, how we fly, like, the whole COVID thing is gonna change, like, with TSA and everything, it's gonna be a big, huge change, I think.
I think things are gonna get more cautious.
How cautious they're gonna be and stuff like that. But
I'm glad. I think there's gonna be less flights in general, and it's gonna cost more to fly. So, you know, we will see. The world has changed for sure.
Yeah, because like it was like that constant like dip, and then like it was like cost or like low cost for flights and stuff. Because I had a round trip to Nashville, I think last month, and I only paid like $50. So, it's like, you know, once everything somewhat comes back to normal, like it's gonna like dip and then rise again. But then you're gonna have those places that's probably like gonna, you know, have all these like discounts and stuff, because they want people, like they need the tourism, so they're going to like offer all this stuff. So it's, I think it's going to be like in the middle with everything, because like they're going to, you know, in certain states, like tourism is like a big thing, like Florida, for example, they're probably going to have like different like deals and things like that, and you know, wanting people to come back, maybe like Vegas or something like that. So,
they'll pay you to fly to Vegas at some point. I feel like they're gonna be like, here's $50, come to Vegas.
Yeah, I read somewhere that they were paying Southwest. This was Southwest and some other airlines that they're paying for the flight to Vegas. Because, you know, for the tourism, like, they were paying for people to go to Vegas. And I think, I don't know if the room part was true, but I know they were paying for, like, the flight there. Because they want people to, like, come back and, you know, so the tourism can, like, you know, run again. So, it's nuts. I think I also saw something, like, Japan was like paying for like half of your trip and stuff like that. It's crazy to just like think about, honestly. And I miss traveling so much. I'm like, should I wait till next year? but I do want to, like, it's so hard because it's so many risks, and then like you don't know what the travel restrictions are, you know, wherever you're going. So it's tough.
You know, my one of my bosses has been in Greece for like a work sabbatical, and he's getting back at the end of this month, and he's been gone for like 8 months. He's also an infectious disease doctor, so he was working on the response in Greece for COVID. He was already there when it hit, so it was just kind of like, he's like, well, I'm here, so I'll work on it. But he's coming back, and like he's got to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Like, even though Greece has like no cases and they only had like 100-something deaths, it was super low. Mm. But we messed up, frankly. Like, we messed up, and we're dealing with the consequences of messing up, and we will be dealing with those consequences for a long time, including not being able to go places. Like, right now, if you're an American, there are lots of places that you can't fly to because they won't let you in. The like travel ban we did on China, you know, we are that to other places.
New Zealand had no cases and no deaths and no active cases. There's not a single person in New Zealand who has COVID right now.
Wow.
Yes. Or it's one. It's either one or zero. I know that they were at one a couple of days ago. I believe they're at zero now. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. I'm very sorry. But absolutely nobody, but also they closed their border. They're not letting people come in. And they did a strict lockdown. They said, we are totally shutting everything down. And it only took a, you know, like, I don't know how many weeks, but they're like totally reopened. They don't have cases. But it's because swift leadership, you know, like strong restrictions, and saying like, nobody can come in, we're gonna deal with this internally, and then we're done. And we didn't do that here. So we're still dealing with the consequences, and people are still dying. We're, you know, people aren't talking about it as much, given the protesting and the spotlight on police brutality and racism that's catching headlines, because the media loves to show cops beating people up and killing people. Not that that's not important, it is the issue of our time. COVID is still here and it is still killing people, which is why it's really important to continue to remember that as you're protesting, as you're getting out there, as we're easing some of these social distancing restrictions, as businesses start to open, that doesn't mean it's gone, because it's not. It's still here and it's still killing people. So if you were at risk before, you're still at risk. Please be careful.
I wanted to know, like, with now, with having COVID, will things be, like, different of how to handle any other, like, infectious diseases, like, maybe, like, a second strain of COVID or Ebola or the flu? Will there, feel like there'll be a change in, like, how the response, like how fast the response will be?
It is a great question. That's unfortunately I don't have an answer. I think that's really wait and see. You know, there are, you know, conferences constantly for academics as well as practicing doctors in the field, where they get together and they exchange ideas. I got to go to one last year. I was in DC. Really, really cool. It's like a week long, and there's people from all over the world that come and share research and talk about methodology. And during the keynote, they actually talked about what the next pandemic was going to be. And they're like, we anticipated being this RNA virus, whatever. A couple months later, there's COVID. You know, like it, they are really good at knowing where diseases are, but we're not good at necessarily projecting the trajectory of them, what they're going to look like over like a long period of time. In terms of like how we're going to handle ones in the future, you know, there are people who spend their whole lives preparing for stuff like this. You know, when COVID popped up, there are people who have been working in the field for decades, and this is the moment where they're activated with all of the plans that they put in place and the things that they've had in their back pocket for a moment like this. I think things will change. I'm excited to see what people in healthcare do moving forward, and what the focus is on, and where leadership is, and how resources are allocated. It's like a criminally underfunded field of medicine, because people don't think about infectious disease if there isn't infectious disease happening. It's happening all the time. We have the flu every year. There's all kinds of infections that you can get when you go to the hospital. One of like the main reason why people die when they're in the hospital, they're otherwise healthy, is hospital acquired infections are serious business. But we want to focus on, you know, I say we, again, not a doctor, focusing on like, how do we better inform the public about infectious disease? How do we tell people that vaccines do not cause autism? How do we talk to people about, you know, being healthy in your day to day so that we don't have to worry about COVID happening the way that COVID happened. We want to be better. There's so much we're going to learn from this, and we'll be, you know, researching this for decades to come. Like, the things that are happening right now are history, and we are going to continue to learn from them. I'm looking forward to it. I just want this to be over, frankly.
Same.
But I'm like, I'm ready to be done.
Right. I'm glad you kind of touched on like vaccinations and autism. Can you talk about that a little bit more and like what your research and things are doing, if you have anything?
Yeah, I am, again, not an expert in this field. I do work with infectious disease doctors who have who are huge proponents of vaccinations. Mm-hmm. The study that a lot of anti-vaxxers point to in connecting vaccines to autism has been widely debunked. Even the person who published that study came out and said this was a really small sample size. The methods that we used to analyze this data were flawed. And they denounced it and retracted it. So, unfortunately, those views have been amplified on social media and by certain celebrities. But we do not have proof that vaccines cause autism. We have proof that they don't, in a way. You know, science is about, you know, not ever, like, I guess it's like, we don't have a way to say that vaccines cause autism because we haven't seen it. It's just not there. We don't have the data to say that that happens. There's no link. They're safe. My favorite thing that I saw when I was at ID Week was the director of the NIH, the National Institute of Health, came. He is in a cover band, which was very interesting. He's a top government official, and he plays in a cover band with a lot of scientists. It's like his weekend activity. They're learning the guitar, and that's sort of like what he does on his downtime. He wore a shirt that says, "Vaccines cause adults," which was one of my favorite things.
Wow.
Vaccinating your children will help them live longer. You know, they're less likely to die if you vaccinate them. And there is no data that suggests a link between autism and vaccinations. If it helps your kids live longer, we don't know what the roots of autism are. It's an ongoing, you know, issue in science that research is still trying to figure that out.
So there's genetic testing and things like that?
About, what do you mean?
No, I'm saying, like, is there, like, is there, like, any, I don't know if this is of your expertise, but is there, like, genetic testing, or they're, like, trying, like, is autism, like from genetics, or, like, it's a part of the research? Because I was just curious of, like, how, I know that's not part of your expertise, but just, like, the, like, how this, like, the research works of, like, finding, like, where autism comes from. Is it, like, a genetic thing or, you know, biological? I don't know. I'm not.
I don't know either.
Yeah, so, I was just, like, thinking out loud, like, you know, with the research, like, I wonder, like, do they do, like, genetic testing or something like
that? I'm happy to look at some stuff and send it over to you if you want to read about some of that. Like, I'm happy to shoot some of that stuff your way. I'm sure you've done a ton of research on your own, but if there's anything that you see, academic articles are really expensive, and there's no reason why it should cost $30 to read an academic article. I can't say this because I'm being recorded, but let's just say somebody wants to email somebody and be like, "Hey, have you seen this article? Maybe you could give me a copy of it."
and maybe somebody else might be like, yeah, I'll send it over to you. But like, we didn't have this discussion. I'm happy to, you know, my employer doesn't know that I'm sending you academic articles.
Right? Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
But there is, yeah, I mean, that's another disparity, right? Another disparity is that I have access to research articles because of where I work. And as somebody who is a mother with children on the spectrum, it would cost you dozens and dozens of dollars just for one article to get research related to autism. It is absolutely unacceptable.
It is insane. That is insane. I'm speechless because that can help in any, that can be a big help in, you know, gosh, I'm speechless. I can't believe that. I can't. That's insane to me. That's heavy. That is so heavy.
I'm not trying to make things heavier. I'm sorry.
But this stuff needs to be talked about because, you know, people don't know. And, you know, no matter how I feel about it, like, this is the reality of it. And it's so, covered up, I guess, you know? And now all the stuff is coming out and then, you know, people have to deal with it. People have to, like, cope with it. And it's a lot. But it needs to be said because it's important. So, even if it's heavy for me, but I know to somebody listening, it's helpful. And then, you know, that might spark something as far as change, you know, with research and, you know, how it affects people and how it can help people, you know? So, you know.
For academic articles, your local library is a great resource. Mm-hmm. There's not every library, especially libraries in urban communities, have the funds to pay for subscriptions to academic journals. They're really, really expensive. If there are colleges or universities in your community that have community outreach programs, mm-hmm. You can email those libraries and request specific articles. A lot of them are only for students and faculty of that institution.
Wow.
Not having access to information, we have the internet, it's great, but not having access to data, not having access to studies is an inequity. You know, it's not just, it's an injustice. There is a push to make that information more accessible in academic communities, specifically in schools of social work, and a lot of departments of African American studies are doing those pushes to make that less inaccessible to the general public. You should be able to read what people are researching. There are certain databases online, the World Health Organization and some of the National Institute of Health studies are accessible to the public after a certain amount of time because they're funded by the government. However, not all studies are. And you also wouldn't know where to look for them because they don't advertise it. So why is it that somebody like me knows about that? Part of the reason is because I went to the University of Pennsylvania for undergrad. Big part of that is who my family is. They don't have university connections. My mom taught there as an adjunct, but like, you know, I went to a school that had high acceptance rates to Ivy League universities. It just like happened. I went to Community College of Philadelphia after high school because I didn't know what I wanted to do. Did community college for 4 years, ended up getting into Penn to finish there, thinking like, I did this myself, you know? And was
was met with a very clear realization that no, it's not just the hard work that I did, it's structural systems that allowed me to get there. But like being somebody of like a lower income, I'm still strapped with student loans, I'm still dealing with those types of things. However, I still have access. I still have, being able to walk around my campus without campus police asking me what I'm doing there. You know, there are lots of differences about what my experience is like. And now having had that education, I can work in a place where I can still get this data for free. So like I can still log on and find any academic article I want to and not have to pay for it. So the availability of that information to a specific group of people is an injustice. You should be able to read about that. Why can't anybody log on and read about it? You know?
No, please, like educate us, like we need to know this. Like,
so if you're interested in making some changes about that, I will shoot you some links about change.org petitions, but I also recommend emailing your local college or university, their library, and demanding community access to academic materials, especially if they're receiving taxpayer funds from the city to operate there. And the University of Pennsylvania, you know, receives money from the city of Philadelphia, and they operate in a way where they don't pay taxes the same way. So there's lots of benefits that they get from the city.
Mm-hmm.
They say that they give back to the community, and they do in a lot of ways. I don't want to discount the ways that they do. However, they also fund the Philadelphia Police Department. So we're sending, some of my friends and I are sending emails to Penn saying, defund the PPD. Like, why are you giving them money? And that's return alert of the police. You know, it's not, obviously not like the taxpayer dollars, but like they're donating money to police interest groups. And then also talking about education justice and access to academic articles and equal access to do education for the community. Really making an effort to get out there and put their money where their mouth is in educating the land of people that they pushed out to create more space for their university.
So that's basically what's going on with the cuts that I'm hearing about, like the city cuts, that mm-hmm. they're cutting a lot of people's jobs, and they're trying to like fund like more like the police stuff. So basically what you're talking about is like that, those cuts that I'm reading about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's
cuts in Philadelphia. They're cutting community programs, they're cutting housing expenses, and increasing the budget of the Philadelphia Police Department. It's the only department in Philadelphia that is getting a budget increase. Every other department in the city of Philadelphia is getting budget cuts except for the police. So, part of my journey to allyship and trying to show up and be better is demanding that Mayor Kenney defund the police. It is not working. Reform is not working. I'm reading a great book by Alex Vitale right now called The End of Policing, about abolishing the police force and what that looks like. Step one being defunding them. But it's absolutely insane that the city of Philadelphia is increasing the police budget so much when they're cutting much needed programs for like the arts and education budget. Gutted. I think the arts budget is completely gone. The education has been, they cut like the mural arts program budget is cut. The education budget isn't cut. The housing budget isn't cut. all of the things that we expect from our city services have been cut. However, police department has not been. It's absolutely insane. Shocking, but not surprising, you know?
Right, definitely.
Like, it's not a surprise, but it's still shocking to see those numbers, you know? So that's what's going on in Philly right now.
Right. So, the resources, the services, like, for, like, probably, you know, for people with autism, that's probably limited. And then also, like, the programs that's needed in the low-income communities are pretty much gone. How can we build the community if the funding is being taken away?
I said something like half of deaths by police are people who have mental health issues.
Yes.
We're not investing in community mental health. We're cutting money from that. Absolutely unacceptable. And it's not something that can continue. It's not sustainable. Like, people are dying every single day because of it, and the communities that need it the most are the ones who have the least access to it. And mental health justice is something that we should be focusing on.
Yes.
It's not here. It's not the center of the conversation, and it needs to be.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you touched on that, because it's the gap there, the gap in between those communities not getting the things, getting the resources that they need. I'm so happy that you touched on that. That breaks my heart. And me knowing this, and like you, like literally going into detail about what's happening, just mind blowing.
If anybody is listening to this and they're looking for ways to help, there are a bunch of resources online. Just Google them. Do not ask a Black person to send them to you. Do your own research. But it's out there. Google mental health justice. You can look at the budgets of the city or town that you're in. See how that space is supporting mental health care for both communities of color and communities in poverty. There is overlap. There's not exclusive, it's a Venn diagram, but we want to make sure that we're supporting both. Both are important and both are underserved. Writing to your local representative for your city and your state. Write to both of them. You can write to your congressional representatives as well as your U.S. senator. However, change really starts local, so start with your city or your town. I can write to Pat Toomey all day. He's not going to listen to anything that I say, right? So we can worry about voting Pat Toomey out in 2022 because he's gone. We do not like him. But who is more likely to read my email, right? Like, I'm more likely to get my email read by somebody like Ryan Sims than I would be by somebody like Pat Toomey. So,
absolutely.
Being effective with our time, not just scrolling through Twitter, not just posting Instagram stories or whatever. It's like, how are we effective with the time that we have? So reading resources, taking direct action, Googling about like what you can do. I can't go out and protest because I live with people who are high risk. It's been awful. I've been very sad about not being able to go out. But there are a lot of people who are in the same boat, you know, like we're in the middle of a pandemic.
True.
Can't protest, that's okay, you know?
Okay, that's not.
You need to like do something.
Yeah, that's not, you know, protesting is not the only avenue in, you know, in what we're doing. like it's so many other avenues. Like, you know, we have these platforms, and you know, we, as you said, you know, speaking out to our local lawmakers and stuff like that. And I've been preaching that for forever, and the people don't understand that. Like, you need to, it starts from the bottom up.
Yeah, and voting is crucial. Voting is not a replacement for direct action, but it's also something that, it's something that works in tangent with direct action. So if you are privileged enough to be able to vote in this country, because a lot of people are not privileged, you have the privilege of voting, please use it. So many people are disenfranchised, especially people of color, immigrants. So if you are lucky enough to have the right to vote in this country, you need to vote. Give me 1 second. Hello? My stepdad had a negative COVID test. We're happy about that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yay!
That was that call, so that's good.
Okay.
Yeah, so those things work in tandem. If you're looking for things to do, there's tons of stuff for you to do. Find out what you like and care about and ways that you can be helpful and figure it out. Like, put in the effort. Communities of color have been putting in the effort for ages, time that white people get up off their asses and do some reading and do some work. And listen first before you do any of that.
Mm-hmm. That's big. I don't think there's nothing else that needs to be said. I appreciate you coming on and sharing like the ins and outs of, you know, your career and your thoughts. It's been pretty awesome. I'm so happy that you were able to come in and talk to me about it.
Thank you for sharing all of your stories with me too. You know, we met online like not very long ago.
Right.
I don't think we talked about how we met. Do you wanna share the story? We can go ahead and share it if you
want. Oh yeah, so we basically we met on Twitch. You know what? I've met some of the most amazing people from online. So like I don't have like any like caution with meeting people online or talking to people online, because like I've met like my best friends, you know, from like wrestling groups and just online. So we've met on Twitch. So WWE superstar Drew Gulak did something for Blackout Tuesday to amplify Black voices, and you know, some of us shared our stories and, you know, what our thoughts are about everything. So that's how we met, and I'm so glad that we like exchanged like social medias, and now from, you know, being here now and talking and you sharing your stories and me sharing my stories and this flourishing into something, like I'm just so excited. Like, this, it's amazing the power of the internet can pretty much like build friendships, build relationships, and like actually create change. Like, I'm just like excited. I'm just happy to speak to another adult.
I love speaking to other adults.
So I don't get to, I'm around kids all the time. I don't get to talk to adults. So I'm just like over the moon. So I'm so grateful to have you on today. And oh my gosh, I wish I was in California, because
you know, once this whole pandemic's over, bring the kids, we'll hang out.
Yeah. I might have to put something together and and overcome my fear of just going, just go. Not much of the fear of flying or anything like that, because like I've gotten over that. Just like,
oh, I had the same thing with coming here. I was like, oh, I might do it, and then I just bought the ticket. You know, like, yeah. I never used to do stuff like that. That's taken years of therapy for me to get there. So.
I've done solo trips, like just flying to like different places, and it was so satisfying. Like I loved it. I think now the more of the fear is just me taking the different precautions now. I don't think it's not even the fear of just going there. It's just like now we're in
a different world.
Yeah, exactly. So like that's more of the fear there. I'm about to just be like, let me buy my ticket and I'm coming because I need to get out. So.
I'm so grateful for you asking me on, and so grateful for the stories that you've shared with me in the short time that we have known each other. I have so much gratitude for your candor in sharing all of your stories, things that are really difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
And you really opened your heart up to people who you don't even really know that well. And it's been really, really insightful for me. And I'm happy to know you. This was a really serendipitous thing that happened. So, this has been great. Your heart is beautiful. And I've been happy to be able to see some of that. But
thank you. I appreciate it. Because, like, we can't live in. We just can't live in fear or live in like the unknown. Like I've always been like a spontaneous person and just pretty much just go with my heart. So like I just like, you know, I'll deal with whatever happens later, but I'm just gonna go with my heart and, you know, I'm gonna be passionate about whatever. That's like, I'm a very optimistic person. Like I've always been like that. And like, you know, some people like will try to take advantage, but I'm also, you know, I have strength. So like, I don't know. I've always like just I love people and I always wanted to learn from people and, you know, all those things. So like once I've like been through my hardships and dealt with my heart, that made me open a little bit more than previously, where I was just like, and you know, and the crazy part is I still like kind of had my heart open then when I was going through, you know, my heart, like my like hardships, because like I've been through a lot, and like for me to still have, and probably for anybody else, to still have an open heart and still have like appreciation for people and all that stuff is like, that's one of a kind, that's one in a million. Like that's amazing. That's
resiliency. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the thing. Mm-hmm. Resiliency, you can't buy it, you can't, you know, like it exists or it doesn't. And you know, it's too much. Like I was talking to my coworkers today and they're like, it's too much, I'm tired, you know. It's so much, and I hope that you get a chance to breathe this weekend. I know that there's a lot going on, but I hope that you get just like a little bit of a break.
I hope so too, but I also have to think of like the possibility and be realistic of like my job. I'm actually supposed to be going protesting tomorrow, but I'm trying to see how everything will play out. So, I don't know.
Stay safe.
Yes.
Free mask.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Whole conversation was great, yeah. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how the one a little bit earlier went. Because I'm sure there's some great stuff in there too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you hear and want to support this podcast, please click the link in the show notes. Also follow us on social media. This podcast was created and produced by Yasmin Nicole of Geeky Natural Mind Media. and also distribute in sponsorship with Anchor. And for next time, shine your light.